On this Selected Shorts, we celebrate a modern master, a leader of the Harlem Renaissance, writer Langston Hughes. I'm your host, Tegel F. Bouget. Join me for humor, social commentary, and a literary snapshot of the Jazz Age.
Sunday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Bob Dylan is North America's finest songwriter. Next time on The White Load of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we hear British and Irish covers of Bob Dylan songs. So tune in, please, to British and Irish covers of Bob Dylan songs on Sunday afternoon at 3, right after Folk Plus.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is the writer Teresa Tulipano. When I attend Yarnslinger events, I wonder about the performers, what influenced their writing, their sense of themselves, their desire to perform. Teresa Tulipano is one of those Yarnslingers. Teresa has lived not just in the Catskills, but in Miami, San Francisco, in England, and in Panama. When she lived in England, her family traveled all through Europe. In the first half of the show, we'll hear about living in England and one of her favorite countries, Tunisia. In the second half of the show, we're going to talk about music. Teresa, welcome to Catskill Character. I'm so happy to have you with me today.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here, Donna.
So we're going to jump right in and start when you were 3 months old. Your parents moved from the San Francisco Bay Area to England, and you lived in England until you were 7. What can you tell us about those first 7 years of your life?
They were really formative. I spoke with an English accent. I loved the culture there. It was really focused on the arts and on music. And I loved going to school in a little uniform.
Well, that all sounds really nice, but you did tell me that when you did go to school, you were bullied. Was that because you were American?
Yes. Even though my sisters and I all had English accents, we were always called the Americans. And teachers would often say things like, well, they might do that in America, but not here.
Even the teachers were giving you a hard time.
Yes.
Ugh. So I love that you and your sisters had an English accent up until the time you were 10. If someone says to you, oh, Teresa, put on an English accent, can you still do it?
Of course I can. This is what I sounded like when I lived in England and I was a small child.
You sound very, very proper.
That was my proper English accent. You picked that up nicely, Donna.
One of the advantages of living over there, whether you live in England or France or Italy, you can travel all over the place. You and your family took advantage of that.
Yes. I mean, we went all over Europe, which I definitely loved. But I would say probably our favorite place that I went was Tunisia in Africa, Northern Africa. For me, I think probably the most outstanding memory was riding camels regularly.
What was that like?
I loved it. We stayed in a hotel there for about a month, and they had camel stables in the bottom floor of the hotel. And so at night, my sisters and I would steal sugar cubes from the dining room and the restaurant, and we would go down to the camel stables to feed them sugar cubes. But we got caught because one night my younger sister got bit by one of the camels. So,
oh no,
we got into big trouble for sneaking out of our room.
Oh boy. You moved in 1977 and you went to Panama. You were 7. Is that where you found out your father was Panamanian?
Yes. In fact, I think possibly because there was so much focus on us being American when I lived in England, it didn't occur to me that my father wasn't American until we moved to Panama and we heard him speak Spanish the first time. It was very shocking for me, but he had been born in the Republic of Panama and moved to the U.S. when he was 14.
So you heard him speaking Spanish and you were seven, but you recognized, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture.
Well, I can clearly remember feeling betrayed is the wrong word. It's too strong, but a sudden awareness that my parents were keeping secrets from me. Or that there were things I didn't know. And that was unsettling for me, certainly.
Mm, yeah. And that can really lead to trust issues. Because if your parents are keeping secrets from you, you start to not necessarily trust everything they say. So that's a tough one.
Yeah, it was.
Didn't you tell me that your family ended up staying in a Holiday Inn in Panama for about a year?
Yes, in a neighborhood called Punta Paitia, which was a very fancy neighborhood. Holiday Inn sounds kind of crummy when you say it now, but it was an American hotel. And so it was actually a bit fancy in those days. We had the run of that hotel, my sisters and I. Living in the Holiday Inn was kind of fun. My sisters and I were able to order room service unlimited. And we would swim in the pool all the time. I had a swim teacher named Oscar, who I remember very well. He was like an elderly gentleman with curly white hair. And he used to say, kick dat feet, kick dat feet. And I think that was most of the English he knew. But I liked to order him a cheeseburger after class. And I would sit by the pool with him and share a cheeseburger.
So you got there in 1977, and from what I understand, that's just around the time that the Constitution was amended that was going to provide a gradual return to democracy. But that didn't really happen until 1990. So there must have been like constant turbulence.
Well, prior to President Jimmy Carter, may he rest in peace, signing the Panama Canal Treaty with Omar Torrijos, who was the president of Panama at that time. There were quite a few protests. On every wall was spray painted, Yankee, go home. Panamanians did not want Americans there in the country because the U.S. military occupied the Panama Canal Zone. My family was not military. My dad actually worked for a bank. But there were a lot of Americans who worked for American corporations like my dad, who lived in Panama City. So we went to school on American military bases, but we were not part of the Panama Canal in any way other than just living there.
I understand what you're saying because you really weren't in the military. But did that have any kind of impact on you as an American? You know, obviously they were not very happy about the Yankees, quote unquote. What kind of an impact, if any, did it have on you?
Well, you know, I have this memory of being on a school bus on our way to the Canal Zone and seeing other school buses, like rioters, turning over other school buses and literally setting them on fire. That we drove past that. And my little sister, who's 2 years younger than me, said, why are they doing that? And I said, well, that's just what they do in Panama, because we were new there and we thought that that was just what they did culturally, sort of like riding the camels in Tunisia or riding a double-decker bus in England. I saw it. I was quite blasé about the riots that we saw. So we weren't actually afraid. We were more curious about it.
Well, one could say that's such a great result of you being exposed to so many different cultures and so many different things, is that you don't react with any kind of hysteria.
Yeah, I think that definitely formed who I am quite a bit, was the constant travel and having to assimilate. I was often the other everywhere that we went. So learning how to become part of the majority was something that I was adept at as a child.
Well, in 1984, you moved again. This time you came back to the States and you went to Miami, and that's where you spent your high school years. But Miami was pretty volatile also. You said it was kind of like Miami Vice. What are you going to tell us about that?
Well, it really was. Miami Vice was on TV at that time, but it really was this wild blend of alligators and cocaine. My high school was near the Florida Everglades, and it was quite open, the drug use. My high school had teachers that you could bribe with cocaine for A's, which sounds shocking, but it was just an open secret there. Parents of friends of mine were definitely dealing cocaine. And I can remember one person in particular. They had lots of guns around the house. And when I asked why, they said it was in case someone came to steal the safe. But the safe contained lots of money and lots of cocaine. So it was a very unusual experience. And I don't think that if my parents had really thought about it, they would have accepted the transfer to Miami, because it was a really bad place to have teenagers.
Yeah, I'll say. One of the funny things that you told me about was that's where you really learned to speak Spanish.
Yes. In Panama, everyone spoke English. But in Miami, that was not the case, at least in 1984 when we moved there. So I did not really learn Spanish fluently, at least in the Republic of Panama, which is a Spanish speaking country. I learned it quite fluently my first couple years in Miami because I really needed it to get along.
Was it more like a Spanglish kind of Spanish, or was it straight up Spanish?
Spanglish is spoken everywhere where there's predominantly Spanish speakers in America, I believe, or in the United States of America. But yeah, I'm telling you, I really needed it. I mean, I really needed to learn it. I had some education from Panama. I'm not going to say I didn't speak any there, but I certainly got fluent in Miami.
Well, in your late 20s, now this really stood out to me. You were hired as a VP at Bank of America, and I'm having a hard time seeing you loving that position.
I did not love that position. It was kind of a fluke that I got the job. My dad had worked there for 40 years, and I was managing bands and stuff in San Francisco, and my dad was worried about me not having health insurance, so he really pushed me to apply for a job there. And I don't like to lie, so I applied only for jobs that I didn't think I could get that needed an MBA or whatever, which I didn't have. And that way I could tell him I applied for jobs, but sadly they didn't hire me. However, they did hire me. So I managed market data for two trading floors in San Francisco for 4 years.
But that was not your love. That was not what you wanted to do with your life.
No, not at all. In fact, the same day that I got the job at Bank of America, I actually got hired as a reporter for the Contra Costa Times, which was a East Bay newspaper. And I was covering nightlife, so like bars and bands and stuff. And I took both jobs. So I was able to sort of by day make a lot of money doing something I hated. And at night, I was going to all of these venues and writing reviews of the troll factor of each bar and whether they made a good kamikaze or not.
Oh my God. When I asked you to be on the show, I had no idea that your life was this exciting. What a journey. So we're going to take a break here, and in the second half of the show, we'll hear about your love affair with music after the break. You've been listening to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is Teresa Tulipano. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're talking to James Beard Award winner Muhammad Abdul Hadi about Philadelphia's Down North Pizza, a restaurant that's slanging pies and saving lives. Literally. Find out more coming up on The Splendid Table.
Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, a conversation with Wynton Marsalis.
I was always interested in social things. I was always outspoken in classes. I had to deal with a lot of segregation and prejudice my entire life. Always was a fighter for it, even if I was alone.
That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character, here today with my guest, writer Teresa Tulipano, a frequent performer with Yarn Slingers. In the first half of the show, we heard about Teresa's early years living in England, the Republic of Panama, and Miami. Teresa spent some very wild teenage years in Miami, which she likened to Miami Vice. When I spoke to her earlier, she talked about the FBI using her driveway for surveillance of their neighbors. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking about Teresa's deep dive into music. Teresa, music has always played an important role in your life. Oddly enough, your mother didn't like music. I don't know if I've ever heard of anyone straight up not liking music. You know, maybe they don't like opera or maybe they don't like punk, but she didn't like music.
I don't honestly know what it was about. My mom did pass away when I was 16. So this is one of the unanswered questions of my lifetime with her. She didn't allow us to play music in the house. I can remember when we were little in England, my sisters and I loved the TV show Top of the Pops. And we would sneak to watch that show on this tiny black and white TV my older sister had in her bedroom. Because if our mom heard us playing music, we would get in trouble. I can remember waiting until she left to go grocery shopping and then listening to Top of the Pops and using one of those old black tape recorders to tape the songs off of Top of the Pops so that we could listen to them quietly when she wasn't around.
You had your ways and your methods.
Yes, my sisters and I loved music. And over time, my mom sort of relented a bit because it was such a passion for us. Also, we were all dancers and you need music to dance to. So we spent our lives sort of making up dance routines together. But it was always a contentious relationship with my mom about it. She would say, you know, turn that god-awful racket off. It wasn't genre specific, as you say. And then when we moved back to the U.S. in 1984, my mom suddenly started loving country music. And I cannot explain that. Again, another thing I would love to ask her about, where she's still here, like what happened? What convinced her to start listening to music, and of all music, it was whatever was playing on the radio. It wasn't even like old school, like, you know, Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson or, you know, Hank Williams Jr. It was whatever was playing on country radio.
Oh, so you told me you were actually a frustrated musician. And when you moved back to the Bay Area in the 1990s, music was the heart of the scene there. I'd love to hear what it was like.
I was so fortunate. I feel so lucky because every band that plays comes through the Bay Area. So I just went to show after show. I really went to concerts as a way of life. And I listened to all sorts of music, but the Bay Area produced a really specific sound in the 90s, which I think people would refer to as funk punk or punk funk. I don't know. But I certainly fell in love with that style of music. I always loved funk. I had an affection for punk as well. But the bands that I listened to then were bands like the Brown Fellinis, Fungo Mungo, and I loved this one local band in Oakland called Tang, and I ended up managing them and their record label.
Tell me about Tang.
We always use the, you know, the astronauts Tang as sort of a joke. They were a 9-piece funk band.
Oh, wow.
Most of them had gone to UC Berkeley and they were all scientists. They were all kinds of careers, politics. They kind of went on to do everything, but they were just electrifying for me. The first time I heard them, I was like, I want to work for you guys. Like, what can I do to help you get your sound out? And I really enjoyed the years that I helped them. They sold out a local place called the Elbow Room, which I believe is no longer in San Francisco, but that was a really big deal. We got their albums distributed in Tower Records, which was a really big deal. And their record label started picking up other bands too. It was a really great experience for me and allowed me to be very close to the music.
You know, my association with music from that area is with bands like the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and so many others like that. It's a completely different era. I haven't heard of any of these people.
Well, I'll tell you, all of those bands you just mentioned were still around. You know, when I moved there in 1988 to, I lived there 88 to around 2001, 2002, I believe. I remember seeing the Grateful Dead while Jerry was still alive in the late 80s and early 90s many times. And I saw one of my managers at a bookstore, her boyfriend was in Big Brother and the Holding Company. So
wow,
they were still around. They were still all playing, but new music was there too.
Just for people who may not know who Big Brother and the Holding Company is, that was Janis Joplin's band.
Yes.
So just throwing that out there for you. What about P-Funk, Parliament Funkadelic? They were like kind of like a collective of musicians. And I think George Clinton was a major player in that band.
Yes, he was the leader of that band, along with Bootsy Collins was the bass player. Yeah, they were incredible. There's a really great piece of graffiti art, actually, a giant portrait of George Clinton in San Francisco. Because they were a Bay Area band also.
Right. So if you were to meet someone who didn't really know what funk was, how would you describe it to them?
Well, funk is all about what they call the bottom. So that's the bass line and the drum. It has a lot of danceability and it's often got kind of a fuzzy sound to it, if that makes any sense. I definitely, if you have not heard of funk music or heard any of it, go out and find some. But probably the most famous example in our time was Prince. He was considered to be a funk musician and he was from a long tradition of that.
Right. And we're going to talk about Prince in a second, but I just wanted to mention another band that people might recognize now is Sly and the Family Stone, because that was a Woodstock band. So people around here would definitely recognize that band.
Yes. And Larry Graham, who went on to form Graham Central Station, was his bass player, Sly's bass player, but also he became Prince's bass player for many years. So
Now, you were going out with a music critic, so you went to a lot of concerts, but you did have, I think, one of your favorites was Prince, and you also went to his after show. So I'd like you to tell the listener about that and what his after shows were.
Certainly. So Prince would put on these incredible four-hour shows at stadiums, you know, big stadiums, and he did this for his whole tour. It wouldn't be just in San Francisco or in the Bay Area, but he would play an after show that started anywhere from midnight, 2 a.m., sometimes 4 a.m. I can remember people staying up for that. And he would play another 4 hours. Imagine the stamina and energy that took. I was really lucky. Over the years, I saw him 26 times. A bunch of those were the after shows, and I feel so grateful. I truly have seen thousands of concerts, but nobody played like Prince live. No one. There's no one still to this day that could do it.
Well, speaking of still to this day, I really can't keep up with the music today. But I was wondering, because you do know so much about music and you've had so much experience, if there's anyone who stands out for you in today's scene.
Yes, I can say completely unashamedly that Taylor Swift is the great musician of our time. In fact, if you had told me that being a Swiftie in my 50s was on in the cards, I would have laughed at you, because I sort of dismissed her without ever really listening to her. prior to the last couple years. But she's just, she's tremendous as a singer, as a songwriter, but mostly as a songwriter. Her lyrics are incredible.
You quoted a line from one of her songs to me that was amazing. It was about narcissism. Do you remember it?
Yes. The line goes, and this is actually how I started liking Taylor Swift, was hearing this line on the radio and going like, who is singing this? But she said, did you hear my covert narcissism? Did you hear my covert narcissism? I disguise as altruism, like some kind of congressman. I mean, it's mind-blowing, really mind-blowing. And the title of that song, by the way, is Anti-Hero.
Mm-hmm.
And the chorus goes, it's me, hi, I'm the problem, it's me. Which is, again, just sort of the introspection required of someone that famous to look at themselves and see their own flaws. I find that to be really charming and thoughtful.
Interesting. What kind of influence does music have on your writing?
A tremendous amount of influence. I've always been told by others that I'm kind of a lyrical writer, and I did write poetry for most of my life, but currently I write to the theme of a song or an album usually. So I will pick a song and use it to mine the memories of the time period when that song came out. And then I write those memories. And in fact, my memoir that I'm nearly finished with writing is structured that way, where it's a title of a song is the name of the chapter, and then I write to the memories about that song.
Do you have any performances or anything that you're doing coming up that you want to share with the listener?
Yes, I'm often in Yarn Slingers, as you kindly mentioned, so be on the lookout for those coming up. And I am teaching at One Grand Books on Sunday, February 16th from 3 to 5 p.m. It's a generative writing workshop. It's for writers of all levels. You can email rsvp@onegrandbooks.com for details.
Teresa, I can't thank you enough for sharing such a rich and exciting life with me and the listener today. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. It has truly been my pleasure to be here, and to be a part of the Catskills in this way is extra special for me. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Catskill Character with today's guest, Teresa Tulipano. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 10:30 on WJFF Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
This Week in This American Life. After Starlee and her boyfriend broke up, she became obsessed with breakup songs, to the point where she decided she needed to write one herself. She didn't play an instrument, doesn't sing, but she felt like a breakup song was the only thing that would help. And she met with a songwriter.
It's called My Friends Think You're a Loser, and I felt like it was like the great.
That's good.
I know, but then I like couldn't figure out what to write around it.
Right.
Because I felt like that really fit it all.
Tonight at 6 on Radio Catskill.
The Silicon Valley mantra of move fast and break things seems to describe what Elon Musk's Doge team is doing to several federal agencies.
They are indeed moving fast, and we are concerned they may break things.
What have they broken recently?
Seemingly, possibly a lot of laws.
Plus, the Dems have been in disarray. Maybe that's about to change? On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.